This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Influence of the Dead on Destiny, given in Dornach, December 2nd to the 22nd, 1917. Lecture 1, entitled On the Functions of the Nervous System and the Threshold of the Spiritual World, Dornach, December 2nd, 1917. Today we will continue to add to what we have considered so far. Recently I have tried to show you what human life depends on, in specific and also in more general terms. You will have noticed, even during the public lectures that I held recently, that I was anxious to point out what we need from spiritual science to understand humanity, in order to break free of the thought patterns that human beings throughout the world have gotten caught up in. And they are, in the end, among the causes leading to the catastrophic events of the present World War I. Above all, people must learn to understand where the boundary between the so-called physical world and the spiritual world lies. This boundary really lies right in the middle of the human being. Precisely this is important for understanding the world. The boundary between the physical world and the spiritual world is found within the human being. I have often pointed out, from the viewpoint of spiritual science, the great importance of natural scientific methods of thinking, both for the present and for the future. But this scientific thought really stands, more or less, where it has always stood from its beginnings. You could well say that it is actually suited for spreading darkness over certain important truths of life. Let us be quite clear. It is only today that historical world development is beginning to introduce scientific thinking gradually into world conceptions and views of life. Today, certain monistic or other associations are engaged in introducing natural scientific thinking into general consciousness, often in a shockingly amateurish way. This is only one of the channels through which natural scientific thinking flows gradually into the human soul. A far more effective and incisive way is through publicity. Not by chance, the new scientific way of thinking and the invention of printing entered the development of humanity at the same time, for they are inwardly connected. Everything that humanity has received so far through printed books, with the exception of books containing materials that existed already, came out of scientific consciousness. I mean that the new element came from scientific consciousness. Above all, the way that thoughts have been captured came from the scientific way of thinking. Theologians will, of course, raise this objection. Have we not also printed our theological wisdom and all kinds of religious things throughout the last centuries? Yes, this is true. But where has it led us? The way that human souls have become conversant with spiritual life under the auspices of printing has resulted in the spiritual element gradually disappearing from the sphere of religious consciousness altogether. As you already know, under the influence of natural scientific thought, even Christ Jesus has become the, quote, simple man of Nazareth, close quote. And although he has been characterized in many ways, he has, nevertheless, been placed on the same level as other great personalities of history, even if, for the present at least, still above the others. The real spiritual element connected with the mystery of Golgotha gradually disappeared, at least for those who think that they have advanced to the civilization of our times. I have already explained that the scientific way of thinking was obliged at first to cooperate in producing a certain darkening of the spirit, in support of what the spirits of darkness sought to bring into human thinking since 1879. In the scientific sphere, this is very subtle. Both scientifically trained thinkers and scientific experts who cooperate in the general education of our age and in the formation of the world view are compelled to divert human beings from perceiving the boundary that exists within them between the physical world and the spiritual world. They cannot help this because, out of their very best knowledge and conscience, excuse this banal expression, they must work with science as it is and popularize scientific methods of thinking. A future age will dawn for human thinking. It is terrible that such things are mentioned today, and terrible for those who are educated in a particular line of thought, when certain ideas now ruling in science will be thought comical. These ideas have not entered the consciousness of the masses directly, but influenced them, because scientists, forgive me, are considered to be authorities. I have often pointed out the idea, as I presented publicly in my book titled Riddles of the Soul, that in current scientific thinking one differentiates between so-called sensory nerves and motor nerves in the nervous system. We will limit ourselves to the human being for the moment, although this can also be applied somewhat similarly to animals. It can be shown schematically that, for instance, any nerve, say a nerve of touch, carries the sensation of touch to the spinal cord, yellow in the diagram. The sensations from the periphery of the body reach the spinal cord. Then, from another point of the spinal cord, the so-called motor nerve goes out and the impulse of the will is sent on. In the brain, this is shown in a more complicated way, as if the nerves were like telegraph wires. A sense impression on the skin is led to the central organ, and from there an order goes out, as it were, that a movement must be carried out. For instance, a fly settles somewhere on the body, causing a sensation. The sensation is led to the central organ, and there the organ is given to lift the hand to the forehead to chase away the fly. This is an idea that is generally accepted today. A future age will look on this concept as something very comical, for it is comical indeed for those who can comprehend the facts. But it is an idea that is accepted by the majority of professional scientists. Open the nearest book on the elements of science dealing with these things, and there you will find that today we must distinguish between sensory and motor nerves. You will find that they mention particularly the very comical picture of the telegraph wire, that the sensation is conducted to the central organ and that the order is given out from there for the production of a movement. This picture is commonly found in popular science. The reality is far more difficult to grasp than the primitive comparisons with telegraph wires. Spiritual science alone enables us to understand the reality. An impulse of the will has nothing to do with a process described in so childish a way as an order going out from a physical central organ. In fact, both sensory and motor nerves serve the same function. This can be seen whether the nerve cord is interrupted in the spine or in the brain. In the brain, it is merely interrupted in a more complicated way. This interruption or gap does not exist so that something from the external world is conducted through the one half to the central organ, and then from the central organ is formed into a will impulse and is led further. This interruption or gap exists for an entirely different reason. Our nervous system is built in this way and is interrupted in this regular manner because the boundary between physical and spiritual experience lies at the very point of the interruption. It is only a bodily reflection of a complicated spiritual reality, of course. This boundary exists in us in a very remarkable way. When we enter into a relationship with the world around us, this process is connected with the part of the nerve cord that goes as far as the interruption. Yet as soul beings, we must also have a link with our own physical body. This connection with our own physical body is transmitted through the other part of the nerve cord. When an external impression causes me to move my hand, the impulse to move the hand already lies here, shown in the diagram above, already united with the soul, with the sense impression. and the sense impression is conducted along all the sense nerves and along the so-called motor nerves from A to B. It is not true that the sense impression is conducted as far as C, where an order is given that causes B to give rise to a movement. No, when an impulse of the will takes place, the soul element is already fructified at A and passes through the entire interrupted nerve path as indicated in the diagram. It is quite out of the question that such infantile ideas correspond to any form of reality, ideas that presuppose that the soul is to be found somewhere between the sensory and the motor nerves, where it receives an impression from the exterior world and transmits an order from there like a telegraph operator. This childish idea, which we see again and again, is very strange when found in conjunction with the demand that science must at all costs avoid being anthropomorphic. People demand that we not be anthropomorphic, yet they do not realize how anthropomorphic they themselves are when they say that an impression is received, an order is sent out, and so on. They talk and talk and have not the slightest idea what a mythological nature they dream up about the human organism. They would realize it if they took things seriously. Now the question arises, why then is the nerve cord interrupted? It is interrupted because otherwise we would not be included in the whole process. Only because at the point of interruption the impulse springs over the gap, so to speak, parenthesis, the same impulse, if it is a will impulse, starts already from A, close parenthesis, are we connected to both the world and this impulse? If the entire process were uninterrupted with no break at this point, it would be a process of nature in which we would not participate. Imagine the same process in a so-called reflex movement. A fly settles somewhere on your body, you chase away the fly, and the whole process never fully enters your consciousness. The entire process has its analogy, an entirely justified analogy, in the sphere of physics. Take a rubber ball, for instance. You press in on it and deform it, but the ball fills out again and resumes its former shape. You press in, and the ball presses out again. This is the simple physical process, a reflex movement, except that there is no organ of perception. There is nothing spiritual involved in the process. But if you bring something spiritual in at this point, inner circle of the diagram, and interrupt the process, the rubber ball will feel itself to be an individual being. Of course, the rubber ball would have to have a nervous system in order to feel itself and the world. A nervous system always exists so that we may feel the world in ourselves. It never exists merely to pass on a sensation along one side of the wire and a motor impulse along the other side. I point this out because the pursuance of this subject leads us to one of the many points where natural science must be corrected, if it is to lead to ideas that correspond approximately to the real facts. The ideas ruling today are nothing other than ideas serving the impulses of the spirits of darkness. The boundary between physical and spiritual experience lies within the human being. You see, this piece of nerve, which I indicated in red, serves essentially to place us into the physical world, to convey sensations within the physical world. The other piece of nerve, indicated in blue, serves basically to make us sense ourselves as a body. There is no essential difference whether we experience a color consciously from outside through the nerve cord A through C, or whether we experience the position of an organ from inside through the cord D through B. In the one case, we experience something physical that does not appear to be in us. In the other case, we experience something physical that is enclosed within our skin. The fact that we can experience not only what is outside, but also what is within us, places us in the process that can be experienced as a will process. The strength of the perception varies according to the nerve cords that transmit it. The cord A through C or the cord D through B, indeed a definite weakening of the intensity takes place. When an idea is linked up with a will impulse in A, the impulse is passed on from A. When it jumps from C to D, the whole process weakens to such an extent in our conscious experience that we experience its continuation, for instance, the lifting of our hand, only with the low intensity of consciousness that we possess during sleep. We are again aware of the will when the hand moves, when we have a sensation from another side. Sleep continually extends anatomically, physiologically, into our waking life. We are connected with the exterior, physical world, but are awake only with the part of our being that goes as far as the interruption of the nerves. We sleep through what lies in us beyond this interruption in the nerves, even by day. In the present stage of the development of the earth, this process is not yet physical. It takes place on a certain spiritual level, although it is connected to a great extent with the lower qualities of human nature. However, I have often expounded the secret that the human being's lower nature connects precisely with the higher manifestations of certain spiritual beings. If we were to note all the places in the human being where the nerves are interrupted and draw them in a diagram, we would obtain a diagram of the boundary between experiencing in the physical world and experiencing in the higher world. Hence, I can use the following diagram. Suppose that I indicate here all the nerve interruptions. Here is the head, and here is a leg. Now suppose that a so-called impression goes out from here, and that the interruption of the nerve is in this place, bringing about, quote-unquote, walking. The real process is that everything that we experience through the nerve here is experienced by day in a waking way. And what we experience here as unconscious will is experienced in a sleeping way, even when we are awake. The spiritual world directly forms and creates everything that lies below the point of interruption in the nerves. These things may be difficult to understand when you hear them for the first time, but they should make you aware that you cannot work with the more intimate questions of knowledge of the human being without certain difficulties. When it becomes clear to you that everything above the boundary line, red in the drawing, connects us with the physical world, and everything below the boundary connects with the spiritual world, which we possess only as a subordinate physical image, you will be able to connect another conception to it. Think of the plant world. The plants grow out of the earth, but they would not do so unless they received forces from the cosmos that are intimately connected with the life of the sun and forces generated by the earth. In order to understand this better, read again my essay, quote, Human Life from the Viewpoint of Spiritual Science, end of title. All these cosmic forces, everything that pours in from the universe out of the sun's life, together with all that emanates from the earth, belongs to the life of the plants. This joint action of cosmic and telluric, or earthly forces, is part of the life and existence in the physical world as we must understand it. The forces working on the plants below this line, see drawing, from the earth, together with the plant's germinating force as the seed is put into the soil, are the same kind as those we must seek here, where the red lines are indicated. We must look for the forces that the plant receives from the earth through its roots, above the boundary line indicated in the diagram. What the plant assimilates from the soil through its roots, we human beings take from the earth in a more delicate way, through our eyes and ears, and above all through our skin. Human beings are earthly beings through their nerves, through the form of telluric or earthly forces in the air they breathe, and through the food that the earth gives them. Human beings receive earthly forces through their organs in a refined way, while the plant receives them in a coarser way, through its roots. The plant receives yet other forces as well. It receives forces that stream in from the sun's sphere, from the heavenly sphere, the sphere of the cosmic spaces or universe. Parenthesis, in my diagram, this sphere is indicated in blue. Close parenthesis. They are of the same kind as those indicated in blue beyond the boundary line. Human beings draw out of their bodies what the plants draw out of the universe. Human beings take from the earth in a more refined state the forces and substances that the plant assimilates more coarsely from the soil through its roots. Out of our bodies, however, we human beings draw more coarsely the same forces and substances that the plant draws in a more refined state from the universe. These forces that human beings draw out of their bodies today do not currently exist in the cosmos in the same form. They existed as such during the old moon period, and we have preserved them from that period. Through what lies beyond this boundary line, blue in the diagram, we do not receive our perceptions immediately from the present, but from what we brought over as an inheritance from the old moon period. We have carried the cosmic element of a past age into the present. We have preserved the moon conditions in our bodies. You can see that we are cosmic to a certain extent, and are even connected with the cosmos in such a way that we bear within us an image of what has already been conquered by the universe outside. This is another example of what I mentioned in a previous lecture, that it is not useful to say from a general or vague standpoint that human beings must again have a cosmic way of feeling or take in cosmic ideas. These things are only of value if we approach them quite concretely and if we really know how matters stand. This will place the experimental attempts of the present day on a really sound basis. If we know that everything in the human body, lying beyond the nerve interruptions, is connected with the moon nature, we will be able to find the forces in the cosmos and in the life on earth that make us ill or that heal us. When we begin to understand the connection between what lies on this side of the boundary and the conditions of the earth, only in a finer way than the plant's connection with the soil through its roots, we will be able to discover in a really conscious way the connection between illness and health and the nature of certain plants. These things are still in the experimental stage today. Our thinking must first be placed on a sound basis to form a proper foundation of knowledge for the conceptions and ideas that we develop, so that our thinking may regulate, permeate, and give a certain structure to the social, ethical, pedagogical, and political aspects of life. We perceive that just those people who exercise solid scientific thinking, expert thinking, begin to fabricate, and talk absolute nonsense when they transfer their usual ideas to the sphere of social life. But the sphere of social life is not an entirely independent sphere. Human beings stand within this social life with their physical, soul, and spiritual natures, and it is not possible to separate these things from one another. We must not remain complacent that people are made scientifically stupid in the social sphere, so that they may only be able to talk nonsense where the social sphere is concerned. It is quite easy today to prove that experienced scientists begin to talk nonsense when they cross the boundary between science and spiritual life. In particular, medical professionals produce all kinds of absurdities with the ideas that are gained today in the realm of science when they enter the spiritual sphere. We need not search far afield. Any example taken from human life will serve, for wherever we look we shall find confusion in this respect. For instance, there is a pamphlet by a very good doctor entitled The Injurious Effects of the War Upon the Nervous System and Mental Life. In order not to arouse your prejudice, I will not even say what a good doctor he is. This excellent medical man, however, observed the nervous system, of which science has not even a glimmer of a correct idea, (this can be realized from the few examples I have given today), he observed to what extent the nervous system has been injured by the present war conditions. We need only consider the most primitive examples in order to show how truly sound thinking ceases when scientific conceptions are transferred to what is connected with the spiritual sphere. I will not even say to the spiritual sphere itself. The discussion of such a subject as titled The Injurious Effects of the War Upon the Nervous System and Mental Life makes it necessary to express what is supposed to take place in the nerves through all kinds of ideas taken from the spiritual mental life, naturally the spiritual life that takes its course on the physical plane. This man, for instance, presents the concept of, quote, overestimated ideas, close quote, which is supposed to be justified under certain abnormal conditions of the nerves. Overestimated ideas are a symptom of diseased nerves. What are overestimated ideas? You see, anyone who presents such a concept must make sure that it is real in life. But what is an overestimated idea? This doctor says it arises when the feeling or sensation in the thought is emphasized too strongly, when it is one-sided. Indeed, he brings forward all kinds of vague ideas. Of course, I cannot give you a specific idea of this, but do not ascribe this lack of a clear definition to spiritual science, for I am only reporting what he said. He states that an overestimated thought arises, for instance, if one hates a foreign country excessively because of the war. A, quote-unquote, valued thought would be proper love for one's country, but this patriotism becomes, quote, overvalued, close quote, when the nervous system is irritated. Accordingly, one does not only love one's own country, but hates the other countries. Then the thought has become overvalued. The valued thought is sound, but from the valued thought one must conclude that the nerves also are sound. But if the thought is overvalued, the nerves are injured. Do we meet reality anywhere? If we characterize on the one hand a nerve process and on the other hand a thought that is supposed to have a certain quality? As a thought, it is supposed to be overvalued. The nerve process is on one side and the overvalued idea on the other. People would do well always to think out such things to the very end, for a thought reveals itself as correct or incorrect, as real or unreal, only if it is thought out to the end. For instance, it would undoubtedly be an overvalued thought if I were to think that I am the King of Spain. Yet it would not be overvalued if I really happened to be the King of Spain. In this case, my nervous system would be quite sound, even though the thought is the same. It has the same content. Hence, the thought itself is not overvalued. Otherwise, we must believe the King of Spain to be afflicted with nerve troubles because he thinks that he is the King of Spain. This concept is meaningless. Nevertheless, there is a great deal of talk about these things. There is not only talk, but people form concepts, definitions, and so on. The results are very strange and not worth more than idle chatter. You see, now this doctor has formed the concept of overvalued ideas. The overvaluation of thoughts is now a symptom for disturbances in the life of the nerves. Very well. But his subconsciousness does not feel very much at ease, for subconsciously he feels that while he explains the overvaluation of thoughts, his listeners have all kinds of subconscious thoughts. They think there is a flaw in the argument. But of course this remains in their subconsciousness, for the doctor is an authority. So their impressions must not rise into consciousness. Quote, for the designation overvaluation expresses not only the vivid and high valuation of the ideas in question, but also their overvaluation in connection with the real facts that lie at their foundation. The overvalued idea rules the consciousness to such an extent that there is no room beside it for other objective thoughts, which are also justified. For this reason, the latter are pushed aside and lose their efficacy in the consciousness, and also lose their influence in bridling and limiting the overvalued thoughts. Thus, a one-sided exaggeration arises in the forming of judgments, the one-sided direction in the striving of the will, and the turning away from all other spheres of thought that are not immediately connected with the center of the overvalued thoughts. Close quote. It is more or less like saying that poverty comes from povretta. Quote, "For that reason, the nervous, excited consciousness appears as irrational and mentally ungrounded to the observer judging peacefully. It corresponds to reality when the quiet observer tries to bring the nervous, excited person back into proper thinking and judgment by saying, 'So get a grip, be reasonable.'" Close quote. So, the doctor has spoken of the overvaluing of ideas, of their connection with the nervous system. However, now he becomes somewhat murky in his subconsciousness, for the story is only talk and is not appropriate. Then he goes on with his talk, quote, "We may not, however, automatically treat the overvalued idea as equal to every manner of thinking that is unusually lively or has an emphasis of feeling. Also, everything noble and lofty that moves the human spirit, that makes us capable of great deeds, that brings devotion and inspiration, and that awakens us to exert all of our forces to accomplish a great purpose, all this springs out of great ideas that rule the spirit and give the strength and perseverance of will, without which goal-directed actions would not be possible." Close quote. Overvalued ideas damage the nervous system. They are at least a symptom for it. But actually, everything lofty and noble is as well. There is no real difference. However, we must at least mention that history is also just as much a symptom. Quote, "Everywhere in the history of the individual or of peoples, we see great deeds fulfilled under the influence of the great leading ideas that drove the will of their bearer unhaltingly forward on the same track, in a certain direction, giving the inexhaustible perseverance to reach the goal recognized and striven for, in spite of all struggles and obstacles. What would have become of Galileo, of Richard Wagner, of Bismarck, and many other great individualities, without the force of a leading idea that drove the spirit forward in a specific direction of will for decades and years, in spite of all the struggles and obstacles?" Close quote. Thus, with ideas that were overvalued, extremely overvalued. Sometimes such an attack of honesty is carried out. It gives a scientific direction that explains all geniality as something insane. Because on this basis, a real difference between genius and insanity cannot be found. And I have told you that there are works today that make Christ Jesus out to be pathologically ill, so that actually all of Christianity is the result of the fact that once in Palestine someone named Jesus was not quite bright. This is the topic today for various earnest personalities who are respected scientifically and academically. The emptiness of such thinking comes to light glaringly, such as when the gentleman in question immediately continues, quote, "Yet therein lies the tragedy of the human spirit, that the ideas that fill the consciousness with great power are not always correct." Close quote. Very profoundly is the tragedy of the human spirit explained. Extraordinarily profound. Oh, wait, let me read that again. Quote, "Yet therein lies the tragedy of the human spirit, that the ideas that fill the consciousness with great power are not always correct." Close quote. Very profoundly is the tragedy of the human spirit explained. Extraordinarily profound. And further, quote, "and do not always adapt themselves to the ordered context of the outer world." Close quote. There we have it. How far are these kinds of ideas from the knowledge that can be reached only on the foundation of such examinations as we make here? Certainly, two people may have the same thought substance, but in one case it is luciferic, in the other case Aramonic, and in a third case it may be in keeping with the normal development of humanity. Instead of coining the empty expression overvalued thoughts, we must accept the idea of luciferic or armonic spirituality. Then we shall know that the important point is to recognize whether a human being wills something out of himself or herself, or whether something else in him or her wills it. But of course, so-called science still shrinks from such views. And if we expect real concrete results from science, things become very amusing. Listen to this, quote, "First of all, I will define," close quote, he wishes first to show the symptoms of certain nervous disturbances, quote, "the thoughts that often play the chief role in the nervousness of an individual," close quote. He means also with the modern nationality mania, quote, "the ideas of despondency, worry, fear, and lack of courage and self-confidence," close quote. Very well, these are the things that characterize the disturbed nervous system in the nervous life that is subject to overvalued thoughts. Despondency, care, fear, and lack of courage and self-confidence. Well, such a lecture is meant to be of help somehow. Parenthesis, for this authority probably does not speak merely to cause vibrations in the air, but because he wants to be useful, close parenthesis. Therefore, we would expect this gentleman to tell us how humanity can overcome these problems, because he finds, not only in individuals, but also in humanity, lack of courage, worry, despondency, and lack of self-confidence to be symptoms of nervous disturbances. One would take this for granted. Indeed, he actually takes it for granted, for he says, quote, "Thus, for a time at least, that discontented, discouraged mood can spread among the great masses of the people. This is to be feared more than anything else, for it leads to the abandonment of strong, sound impulses of the will. It loosens the firm, undivided striving after a goal, and weakens the energy and endurance," close quote. Now, we expect something, don't we? He continues, quote, "Not to be nervous, therefore, means above all courage, confidence, trust in one's own strength, and not swerving from what has been recognized as the right course of action," close quote. So, wonderful. Now we have it. People are nervous when they are oppressed by care, lack of courage, despondency, lack of self-confidence. How do they get rid of their nervousness? When they are not oppressed by all this. This is quite clear, is it not? When they are not oppressed by all these things. Emptiness of thought is carried over into substantiality in science. Certain authorities have at their disposal all the material, having taken possession of it. When any attempt is made to work upon the material with reason, one finds that the authorities have already confiscated it. But when they work upon it themselves, they do so with empty thoughts. All anatomical, physiological, and physical subject matter is consequently lost. Nothing is created. For at the very table where something useful for humanity should be produced, people stand with these worthless thoughts. Certainly nothing can come of the dissection of a cadaver when, parenthesis, forgive the hard expression, close quote, close parenthesis, and, quote, empty head, unquote, does the dissecting. Already here the matter becomes social. Things must be considered from this point of view, and a very promising treatise that gives account of a lecture ends in just such a manner. I have given you one example. Not to become nervous means, above all, not to lose courage, confidence, and trust. But when today the average reader takes up such a treatise and reads the title, "The Injurious Effects of the War upon the Nervous System and Mental Life," and thinks, "Here I shall be enlightened, for this is by Professor So-and-so, director of the medical hospital in such and such a place," well, now he is clear about it. Now, naturally, he is enlightened. But on page 12, where national hatred is discussed, we read, quote, "Certainly similar impulses flared up within us, and we found it almost a relief and satisfaction to oppose our greatest enemies with a similar attitude ourselves. And yet only a little quiet consideration is needed to realize that this general national hatred is only the outcome of a diseased, overstimulated mood of soul, into which the various peoples have fallen through mutually inflaming, inciting, and imitating one another." Close quote. How then has the history of national hatred arisen according to this statement? Here are various peoples, A, B, and C, but neither A, B, nor C are in any way of themselves capable of hating. This general national hatred has developed through a diseased, overstimulated mood of soul into which the various peoples have fallen, through mutually inflaming, inciting, and imitating one another. Thus A cannot bring it about, B also cannot, nor can C. But what each is unable to do, they achieve by mutually inciting one another. Consider how ingenious the thought is. I explain something and have before me A, B, and C. All of what I have said is unable to provide an adequate explanation, but provides an explanation just the same. Thus I explain something out of nothing in the most beautiful manner. People pick up these things and read them without observing that they are simply nonsense. It is necessary to point out such things, because they show how disjointed and empty the thinking is that assumes authority today. Naturally, in science pertaining to what already exists, this does not come to light so because it cannot be controlled. But in the same way that people think here in the realm of science, so they also think in social, pedagogical, and political life, and thus has been prepared, and this has been prepared during the last four centuries. This is the present situation. So it has come about that gradually, out of the disjointed, worthless thought, impulses like those that meet us in the present catastrophic events have arisen. Here we must penetrate thoroughly to the roots of the matter. And only when people then come to the surface of things, where the matter becomes actual for the individual human being, and can also become so for the social structure of whole peoples, then the matter becomes especially horribly wretched. It is our task, on the one hand, to grasp these things, is it not? We must learn to know them within their mutual limits, if we are to understand them. If we wish to understand such an event as the present war, which is so complicated and which unquestionably cannot be grasped in its details from the physical plane, we must, as people say, trace it back to its causes. But people believe, when they have traced a matter back to its causes, and have understood it in this manner, that it was a necessity, that it had to happen, just as it has. Today, for instance, we do not in the least notice that the one thing has nothing whatever to do with the other. Just because we understand something in its interrelations does not mean that the event had to take place, that it could not have been omitted. People try to make clear to themselves, in a more or less intelligent way, why the present war had to come, why it is not something determined by a few people, but something connected with deeper causes in the development of humanity. Those people often go away satisfied and say, "Now I understand that nothing else was possible, except that this war should come." It is obviously a necessity in the sense that when we recognize its causes, we see that it develops with absolute necessity out of those causes, out of these concrete conditions. But this does not mean that we may draw the conclusion that things had to happen directly, regardless of what the causes or conditions are, just as they have happened. No event arising in world history is necessary in this latter sense. Although in the former sense it is necessary, no event is necessary in this latter sense. Each event might have been different, and each might not have happened at all. Those who speak of absolute necessity might reflect with the same right, "I would like to know when I will die." Now, if I go to a life insurance company, they reckon out, determining the amount of the insurance policies accordingly, how many people out of a certain number have died in a given length of time and how many still live. The insurance company is paid accordingly. I go to a life insurance company for information, and it must appear from their calculations whether I shall be dead or not in 1920. This is naturally complete nonsense, But it is exactly the same nonsense when we try to derive the necessity of one event from another out of the realization of the cause that must lead to that event. Here I touch upon a theme that indeed is not easy, because in this sphere the most disjointed ideas are prevalent, and in this realm today people have very little will to become clear about things. If we really wish to be clear on this point, we must recognize that when something takes place, it does so under the influence of certain conditions. In the sequence of circumstances, we always come to a certain point where there are beginnings, real beginnings. If today we see a sapling that is still small, we know that later on it will become larger. The size of the tree develops of necessity from out of its smallness. But if the seed had not fallen into the earth at this particular spot, what then? Perhaps someone planted it there. But if no one had done so, then here would be a point where necessity would not have been introduced. Now, however, necessity must begin here. Let us say, we look at a mighty oak here before us. It is not here in reality, and admire it. It was once naturally a sapling and has grown from this sapling according to necessity. But now imagine that a good-for-nothing boy or girl had come along while it was still very small and pulled it up. Because it was pulled up, the whole necessity does not ensue. Also, in a negative way, the necessity may be done away with. Starting points, where the necessities begin, reveal themselves to thinking that conforms to reality. This is the essential point. But we do not come to these starting points when we observe merely the outer course of events. We reach them only when we can, at least, feel the spiritual foundations. For example, when abstract thinkers form a concept of this bunch of roses here, an idea results that copies reality. For to them the roses are real, and the idea copies reality. Whereas, when esotericists form a concept of this bunch of roses, it is not real, because the roses do not exist. The roses can only exist when they are connected with their roots in the earth. The real concept does not result when, from the outset, we form an image of something that is external, but only when out of the reality we reproduce the concept or imagination we have experienced. But this experienced concept yields itself only to spiritual scientific contemplation or examination, even in the case of outer sense reality. A valid concept of an historical world event is only reached when we can view this event according to the methods of spiritual science. Here we find that we may indeed trace the origins of its necessity. We find its ramifications, its roots within reality. But something is accomplished only by actually tracing the roots, not by the general statement of an abstract necessity. For instance, had certain events during the 1880s been different, the events in 1914 would also have been different. But this is the important point, that we do not proceed as the historian does, who says, quote, "What now takes place in the effect of preceding events, these are in turn the effect of preceding events, which are the effect of still other events," close quote, and so on. We come thus not only to the beginning of the world, but still farther into complete nothingness. One such idea rolls along behind the other. This is not the important thing, but rather that we follow the matter concretely to where it first took root. Just as the root of a plant begins somewhere, also, so also do events. Seeds are sown in the course of time. If the seeds are not sown, then the events do not arise. I have touched upon a theme here that I naturally cannot exhaust today. We shall have more to say later, Sunday, on this subject, that I will describe essentially thus. In spite of all considerations of necessity, there is not a single event that is absolutely necessary. It is really essential that human beings of the present day should, in their whole attitude of mind, emerge from this frightful dogmatism that permeates modern science, and that things should be taken seriously. I will close by giving you a good example. At Zurich and Basel, I tried to explain what nonsense it is to consider a sequence of historical events in such a way that one event must necessarily arise out of another. I said that it would be absurd if we were only to consider the one occurrence as proceeding out of the other. This is the same as if I said, here is a light that illuminates first the object A, then the object B, then the object C. If I do not notice the source of the light, I see merely the fact that first A, then B, then C, in turn, become illuminated. I would be mistaken if on seeing first A and then B illuminated, I were to say that B is lighted by A, and when I see that then C is illuminated, I would be in error if I were to say that C is lighted by B. This would be quite incorrect, for the illumination of B and C have nothing to do with it. They all receive light from a common source. I gave this example in order to explain historical events. Now suppose that somebody found this idea quite a nice one. It is possible, is it not, that someone might believe that an idea springing up from anthroposophical soil was quite good. Indeed, here and there, our opponents have taken such ideas to use for themselves. Many indeed have become opponents, because such things had to be censured. Thus it is quite possible that an analogy brought forward from an anthroposophical quarter might not be absolutely foolish. Suppose some person used it in a different context than I had, and used it dogmatically, not symptomatically as I did. Assume that he used it with a quite different attitude of mind, and that I heard him say in a lecture, quote, the sequence of cause and effect is quite wrongly explained by continually saying that effect B is the result of cause A, effect C of cause B, and so on. For this would be the same mistake as when one says when A is illumined, B is illumined, and C is illumined, then B is illumined by A and C by B, close quote. If the explanation were not given in the same context that I used in Basel and Zurich, then I would perhaps object to the lecturer's conclusions based on his connection. I would perhaps say, quote, supposing that A, B, and C are luminescent substances, there are such substances that become luminous when exposed to light and continue to glow even when the source of light is removed. Suppose that A, being luminescent, actually illumines B, and that B, being luminescent, illumines C, then B would in truth be lighted by A and C by B. In this way, the whole analogy can become very brittle when it is used by someone who does not understand that concepts for the realities of spiritual life are like photographs that differ when taken from different sides. If this is not said at the outset, if the lecturer does not lead up to ideas that conform to reality, so that these ideas are always seen from a certain perspective, then what has been said quite rightly from a certain perspective may become nonsense when used in an absolute sense. The difference lies in whether people start from the reality or from ideas. If they start from ideas, they will always be one-sided. But when they try to take reality as their starting point, since they can only bring forth ideas and nothing else, and every idea is one-sided, they must produce one-sided ideas. That is quite obvious. Thus you see that a complete, deep-reaching change of the soul life is essential. For this reason, it is not difficult at all to criticize many ideas I bring. I do not know if anyone would have hit upon this particular criticism, but I already think of everything that needs to be criticized myself. We must be conscious of how the idea is related to reality. Only then shall we be able to penetrate into reality. Otherwise we shall always quarrel about ideas. Today the whole world is fighting about ideas in the social sphere, although, as frequently happens, this fight has been transformed into external deeds. These things lead into the intimacies of the spiritual life. Those who want to understand existence must reflect on such things. I have called your attention to these matters today in a more theoretical way. Next time I will speak of contemporary history from this standpoint, and will show to what extent certain events were necessary, and yet to what extent they were quite unnecessary, and how quite different events might have happened instead. The catastrophic events under which we are all suffering need not have happened at all. We shall speak of these important questions in the next lecture. That is the end of Lecture 1.